Do aliens exist? Is a question that can be explored a little bit. So immediately we can think about the methodology that ought to be used or can be used in connection with attempting to answer such a question. Varying a little bit to, say, critical thought and philosophical thought, a distinction can be made between something that has been called a priori reasoning and observation. And we can think about those differences. So, for example, as it concerns observation, if I want to find out if right now in front of my home is a person wearing a red hat, the only way to do that is to engage with the empirical in some way. I can go myself, look, maybe I have a camera aimed at the street, and I can check that. I can ask somebody to check, and maybe there's some more exotic ways. I can fly a drone out, whatever the case might be, but I have to perceive something. That would be the only way to figure out or hear something, but also it'd be a perception to figure out whether there is a person with a red hat in front of my home. And we say that no amount of pure thought could ever answer the question for me. If I shut myself up in my room and I just try to think, is there a person with a red hat in front of my home? And I think and I think, and I can never arrive at any conclusion that is not arbitrary. I can say yes, I can say no, but I can't think my way to the answer. But compare and contrast that situation with one such that has us answer or think about whether or not, for example, it is possible that two sides of a scale, each of which has the same amount of weight, do not balance each other out, right? For example, meaning, is it possible that on one side of a scale is, for example, 5 pounds, and on the other side is 5 pounds, and it's a real scale, and they don't balance each other out. One side goes higher. Here we see it's a little bit different, because if we were to see a situation such that purportedly is one descriptive, or that can be described by the statement, these are two equal weights, and they do not balance each other out, we would not falsify that statement. We would know that there must be some kind of trick. Again, I see a scale, and on one side it says 5 pounds, and on the other side it says 5 pounds. And yet, one side is higher than the other side. It has to be a trick, or it has to be a broken scale, or it has to not be really 5 pounds on one side. But why? How come observation cannot tell us what the case is here? This is a different sort of thought. Think about what is 1 plus 1. I can think my way to the answer. 1 plus 1 is 2. And there's nothing that I can observe that would falsify that. We could say, what about a drop of water and a drop of water? Wouldn't that make 1 drop of water, thus falsifying the statement that 1 plus 1 need be 2? So, 1, the numeral 1, in whatever sort is employed, the Latin numeral, English, whatever it might be, Chinese, refers to a single demarcated, a single demarcation of any variety. This is different than that. That's 1. And the other 1 refers to the same thing. And the 2 refers to a grouping of the first 1 and the other 1, insofar as they retain their individuality and yet are thought of as existent in the same group. That's why we can apply it to, for example, a stone, and a stone makes 2 stones, because they retain their identity, the stone and the stone, but now they're thought about in terms of a single group. Or I put an apple and an apple in my bag, and now they're physically in one group in my bag, and yet they retain their individuality. So that is descriptive. Therefore, 1 plus 1 equals 2 is descriptive of, if we were to apply it onto our experience, it would be descriptive of elements which retain their individuality, such as apples, unless we put them in a blender or something, or stones, and so forth. It would not be descriptive of materials such that when conjoined lose their individuality, such as water drops. So this, it still holds that we cannot falsify one and one being two. This is a priori thought, it can be said. Another example could be, if the closed space is filled up to the limit, that which fills it after that point must need overflow. It can no longer go in that space. So for example, I have a cup and I fill it up with water, and once it's full, the other water has to go somewhere else, such as hopefully in the sink or wherever. Right. Now we see that this is another example of a sort of thought that cannot be falsified. If I see a cup and it keeps getting filled with liquid and it doesn't overflow, I know for a fact it has to be a trick. I know. Maybe there's an invisible tube somewhere that is taking the water out. Maybe the water is holographic or something. Who knows? But there has to be some trick, because this is a question that can be determined by reason. This is the structure of reality. That which is filled up is filled up. It's a tautology. Therefore, it cannot be more filled up. So the water is that which fills it up. It cannot be that there's more water that then fills it up without overflowing. So anyhow, the relationship between the a priori and the empirical is an interesting one, and has made for much discussion throughout the ages of critical thought. But in connection with this interesting question, whether or not there are aliens, and we would have to, or we can think about whether or not we would try to answer that question with the aforementioned a priori thought, or with empirical observation. Concerning the latter option, we would try to answer the question, for example, by trying to find some sort of evidence. The astronaut said he or she saw some flesh. The pilot said that here was moving something at radical speeds. Ultimate evidence would be perhaps finding bodies that do not possess Homo sapien DNA, right, and yet are not any of the known animals, something like that. And yet we see that any and all observations are theory-laden. It's a myth, right, or just an untutored kind of an intuition that we can simply see something and it'll just be so, right, without any kind of theory, aside from perhaps certain constituent elements of our experience. For example, colors and shapes and such. So for example, if I want to understand what is a scale, I have to first do some a priori thinking. Well, scale is that which balances weights. Therefore, it is that which, if equal weights are placed on each side, will be balanced. So now I'm examining this object, and I have to think, does it conform to this definition that I have in mind? Which can lead to the interesting question of where we gain the elements of our thought in the first place, but perhaps that's going too far off track. But anyhow, we make observations in light of our hypotheses. I look under a microscope, and we hear all this terminology, the DNA, the atoms, the this and the that. These are, first of all, theories, right? And then observations are made in light of those theories. We cannot look under a microscope and see that which we would see if we're trained scientists and know something about some of the latest hypotheses concerning hereditary information and such. We cannot look up at the sky and simply see that which an astronomer with some theory in mind will see. We can see some lights in the sky, sure, but what is that? How does that fit in with the rest of our knowledge of the physical world? We can't see a star, therefore. We can see a light, right? But a star is part and parcel of a vast theory, right? Of a vast series of hypotheses and mathematical conceptual views of reality. And it is then, or the light then is seen in light of those hypotheses. It's a theory-laden observation. We cannot simply see the star, we cannot simply see even the moon the way that we understand it, right? Here's a satellite around Earth. I can see some kind of bright spot in the sky, but to understand it as the moon, I need theory. Just like I can see, say, a person walking, but to say, oh, that's my neighbor, or that's my relative, I need something in my noggin. I need to be, for example, the person who lives next to this person. It's a theory-laden observation. I can't just see my neighbor, right, without the knowledge that, oh, here's my neighbor. Let me look through the microscope. So we see indeed that so much of what we take to be direct reality is in this way theory-laden, and certain kind of exceptions to that can make that apparent. So for example, if a person does not have a natural intuition or instinct that other people are real, as am I, there's no way to demonstrate that, right? Or there's no way to unequivocally show that in experience. I just have to feel that you're real. The psychopath, for example, maybe doesn't feel that way. And there's no amount of looking through a microscope at a person, right, or at cells or at tissue that'll say, oh, well, now you're a real person, right? Think about the relationship that a mother immediately has towards her child. In the vast, vast, thankfully, majority of cases, this is my child. Immediately there's love, immediately there's bonding. But there's no way to, quote unquote, prove that by looking closer at the baby. And in those rare exceptions where a child is born and there's no such reaction from the mother, and we see these gruesome, awful stories in the news, the mother tries to throw out the baby out the window, goodness forbid, this or that. Right? If we were to say, wait, 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 you're supposed to love this child. And look, I'll show you some kind of proof. I'll show you the chemical test. Obviously, you can show a paternity test, but that would be proof of some kind of physical relation, not what we're talking about now, right? There's no way. It's a theory-laden experience to see and love my child, to see another person and understand that, oh, here's a human being just like me, right? To have the emotional connections that we have with things in our life and with our experiences. Right? Let's say that in my home, I feel comfortable, I feel cozy, I have personal connections with my stuff, with my clothing, with my trinkets, with my favorite spot on the couch, this and that, right? Let's say now that's gone. I'm a little depressed, whatever the case might be. How can I get that back? Through simply observing something, right? There was the cozy spot on the couch that I always enjoyed. Now I don't enjoy it. Well, let me get out my, microscope. Right, let me get out my telescope and look a little bit closer at the couch, and that'll show me that that's my cozy spot. No, it won't. Right, so we say, hopefully, we get the point about observations being theory-laden. We cannot simply observe anything and say, oh, well, this proves it. This is the cozy spot on the couch. This is the baby that I love. Right? This is the spouse that I love. Look, I'll show you the report here of the chemicals and the this and the that. So we say, in light of that reasoning, that the empirical approach to a question such as whether or not there are aliens, aside from in the most naive way, is probably highly limited. Again, for one, the entire conceptual world that we live in. Here are people and they're on Earth, and these are human beings and these are animals. These are all, again, theory-laden observations. If we were to take away the theory, we would be in a completely different world, and we cannot say who's the alien and who's not the alien. Who said that what lives in the ocean are not aliens? For example, look at an octopus, a whale. What is that? It's just that we're used to it, and that could be an alien. Right? Who said even that people that look different than us are not aliens? We believe, thankfully, or contemporary thought believes that there's one human family, and everybody that bears the imprint of the Homo sapien is essentially the same thing. And yet that's not a given. It certainly has not been a given historically. The other tribe, the other nation, those are not real people like me. They look different than me, and they don't deserve to live. So they're aliens, right? We think, but location-wise. But what is location? And location also the related observations and concepts and so forth. So if we simply try to observe something, we're not going to get too far concerning such questions. Again, aside from perhaps in the aforementioned naive way of if we go to the moon and we find little green fellows and ladies there, we can make a statement such as that I went from this place to that place up there, and there I saw these little people. But what does that tell us about the nature of reality? What would that tell us? Not that happened. What would that tell us, and what does that really mean? So again, we see by the empirical approach, it's limited. So we're left then with, at present, the a priori approach, thinking critically about reality. Right? For example, the two sides of a scale balance each other out. For example, does 1 plus 1 equals 2? For example, does a filled cup permit of being filled further without overflowing? Thinking about reality in that way and trying to discern an answer by that method. So we can give that a shot. How would we go about doing that? Well, one perhaps angle to take would be to consider what it is that Homo sapien is, or more safely we should say, what is a way to think about the human condition such that is necessary and follows from reason, as opposed to being something that can simply be observed. So one view of things would be to take whatever words commonly circulate in a given milieu, to visualize something, and then to simply say a series of sentences reflective of that. In this case, it would be something like, what are human beings? They're primates that are able to talk. They developed over a long period of time on Earth, the this and the that. And so forth. And then we think about, aliens or other forms of life somewhere else. Another thing to do would be to take direct experience, content that is immediately apprehendable, and see what conclusions can be drawn from there. So we see that whereas I can conceive of a variety of objects in my experience, which include my own body at its different stages of development. I can think of or look at pictures of myself if I have any from when I was a baby, when I was 5, when I was 10, when I was 15, if I'm older than that now, 20 and so forth. Whatever the case might be. And I can also think about the fact that that body must have indeed grow in a particular womb of a woman, my mother, and she herself was once little and she grew in a particular womb, my grandmother, and going back, right, until records are lost. I can do that, right? And I can situate that objectification of myself in time and in space and say I'm alive, say in the 21st century on this continent, in this place. And I can think about all of the innumerable lines, world lines that come together to facilitate my existence. My parents had to meet, my grandparents had to meet, this group of people had to migrate some thousands of years ago from here to there, and these are the cultural undercurrents and so forth and so on. I can do that, and that's awesome to do. It's very interesting. And yet I can also, should I have attained to self-consciousness, I can conceive of myself as, say, self-conscious agency, and such to which those objects come across to, and such as itself cannot be said to have been born on such and such date, to have been the son or daughter of some or another parent, and to have and so forth and so on. That applies to myself as an objectification. It does not seem able to be applied to myself as a self-conscious agent. Self-conscious self-activity, to dispel the notion that in my own self I'm some sort of blank consciousness. No, it seems that volition and intellect in its true connotation is part and parcel of me. It cannot be cleaved off of me. Something like consciousness, something like intelligence, something like volition. freedom, whatever the case might be. So we see that self-consciousness may or may not come around in connection with a Homo sapien anatomy. Oftentimes it does not come around, it seems, in which case the person is entirely an objectification from their own point of view and from each every other point of view. If human development is successful, then self-consciousness should come around at some or another point, be it in one's teens or later than that, or whatever the case might be. Having said that, one may then think, what is the purpose? What is the idea of this seemingly unseemly connection between an animal body, most of the animal bodies, again, having no capacity to attain to self-consciousness, such as cows and monkeys and so forth, and this capacity that we can call self-consciousness? What is the connection? One possible suggestion in response would be to ask, first of all, what is the nature of the attainment of that which can be called self-consciousness? Obviously, by that term can be meant a variety of things. One thing that could be meant is, in the simplest connotation, I get conscious of myself when I walk into a room. You know, I'm not dressed correctly. We don't mean that, obviously. Another connotation would be a sense of, say, disassociation or alienation from one's life. I feel like I'm just an observer. I feel like I'm just being aware of things, and I'm not really in it. That also, it can happen, unfortunately, in connection with trauma. It can be a trick of attention or something that can be used to regulate emotions. Let me pull back and just kind of observe the situation and observe myself. But that's also not exactly the height of what's possible for the human being. Self-consciousness then could also mean a sort of, say, volitional and intellectual turning outward from my creaturehood, from my animal life, to reality, which is truer and more real and more existent than merely the succession of experiences. And I'm thirsty, I'm hungry, I want this, and I want that. I say that in a certain condition and beneath a certain point of moral development, that is my life. Right? I'm a creature, always dissatisfying, always wanting something. I want this and I want that. My physical needs, my psychological needs. I'm narrowed down to just one organism out of so many organisms. We see what happens if a person fails to develop and falls into themselves, into the pit of their own idiosyncratic psychology, in particular physiology. It's called lunacy, or it's called exceptional selfishness and self-centeredness. Normally, a healthy track of life has us transcend ourselves to some or another extent. I have objective interest as I grow older. I care for my family, I care for my friends, I care for my community. A lack of that, and I'm sinking right into myself. And yet, that would be moving in the right direction, certainly, but perhaps there's a step further to take, which would be really, truly giving myself up, again, volitionally, concerning my will, concerning my affections, concerning my desires, to what I take to be reality, which is not external to me. It can be said perhaps to be my own deepest and truest reality, and yet it is not me in the way that I understand myself. Basically, by self-consciousness can be meant entrance into a relation with a reality that is over and above myself as creature. That is also my own reality. It's not alien to me, no pun intended, fundamentally, and yet it's not me. That can be called self-consciousness. Real self-consciousness is attained through truth, through love, through service, through honesty, through effacing of oneself. It's an ethical question. It's not a trick, right? I'm very self-conscious, I'm very enlightened, I'm very this and that. No. If I'm narrowed down volitionally to myself as creature, that I have a bad will, I can pay attention to my breath and to my awareness all day long, and I will still not attain to the end of human life. Now, so far as that suggestion might be in the right direction, that the goal is to attain to something like that, self-consciousness, we could ask again, what is the idea behind having, or what's the idea in light of which we can understand our initial creaturely condition or alienation as animals? Our starting point. And here we see that that is necessary in order for there possibly to be a relationship to reality over and above myself. I have to first be a self, and I first have to be alienated, and I first have to have a set of creaturely claims. I have to be an individual so that I can sacrifice myself willingly. Just like in a marriage, for example, there has to be two to tango. There has to be two persons. And also psychologically, if one of the individuals in a marriage is not individuated, to use that term, enough to where this is a particular person, good luck having a marriage with them. It could be some kind of unhealthy blending, some kind of power imbalance, whatever it might be, but it's not going to be a healthy marriage. A healthy marriage is between two real individuals. They don't have to be super individuals, but to some extent, right, here's one person, here's another person that choose to love each other freely and strive for unity freely while retaining their individuality. So just so here, imagine if, goodness forbid, a child is raised by wolves, say, or raised in conditions such that no language develops and no sense of self develops and that nobody speaks to the child tragically, there's something like that. There won't be a person that could choose to give him or herself up. There won't be an individuality that can be sacrificed so as to attain to a higher life of love and truth and reality. It can be done. So there has to be the animal individuality. And the animal individuality, I have to willingly subdue and sacrifice so as to trend in the right ethical direction. It can further be asked, what are the anatomical concomitants of such capacities? We see that there are no grounds, however much we may wish otherwise, there are no grounds to suppose that such ethical endeavor is possible by the way of any other animal other than the Homo sapien. Not a monkey, not a mouse, not a cheetah, not a chicken. No other animals can do what we do in this regard. What are some of the anatomical distinctions between us and other animals? Well, scholars could make some suggestions in that direction. The brain, the nervous system, an upright posture can be helpful, whatever the case might be. Now, we see that's not the bottom line. The bottom line is not what we look like. We can conceive, in theory, that we would look very different. Right? That we would look like blobs of green jello or something like this. That we would have very different neurological properties. Indeed, there are conditions such as are called hydrocephalus, where an individual may lose upwards of, say, 90-95% of his or her brain. And whereas oftentimes function is lost, there are many instances where no function is lost. And even though a person effectively has only a slight sliver of brain tissue, the rest of it having been drained out or whatever happens in that condition, the person can function just fine in many cases. A person can lose half a hemisphere and be fine. A child can be born with 3% of his or her brain and it can grow back several years afterwards. So we can imagine so many different options concerning the anatomy, concerning the neurology, this and the that. So what counts here then is that a priori account of what it is that a human being can be, of that dynamic between having an animal individuality of having volition, right, and being able to freely move in a direction of self-sacrifice so as to facilitate the existence of uniquely human goods in the universe, such as love, such as good, right, such as relationship, such as individuality. So, with that in mind, we can ask again, are there aliens, and does the a priori style of thought have anything to say on that account? Perhaps bypassing some further lines of more subtle reasoning, it could be suggestively offered and tentatively offered that any account of sentient existence that makes sense would involve some such dynamic as is the case by the way of the Homo sapien, right? Now, what that translates to corporally, what that appears like, as was said, many different things can be conceived of. And indeed, there's great diversity of appearance even amongst Homo sapiens. And as was mentioned, it's a fine idea that we are all one, and that is the appropriate idea, certainly. And yet, it is an idea, and one could very easily say somebody that looks sufficiently different from me is an alien. It is not really me. It would be an error because it would not mind the underlying capacities, which is, again, the main thing. If somebody, say, has no face, unfortunately lost the face during a time of war, right, or was born without a face, as long as that's a person, right? That's still a person. I would be an idiot, and I would be myself extremely intolerant and not such a good person if I were to say, oh, well, that person has no face. They look like an alien. They look like some kind of creature from outer space, and therefore, they're not really human. They're not really a person. And I'm the not human one for saying that, right? Some people have such large tumors growing out of their head that, again, the entire face is covered up and there's no way to tell, like, what is this necessarily? You would have to examine closer. And yet, you can speak to the person, maybe they can speak, and they might be a very nice person, and therefore it's the same idea. I'm an idiot if I say, oh, this is an alien, this is not a person. So what matters is the capacities. What matters is who I am and who I can be, and not so much what I appear as or what I look like. Now, again, trying to use that to shed light on the question here in question, that being whether or not there are aliens. One thing that can be said based on the suggested reasoning is that there cannot be, far as our thought indicates, as was said, a qualitatively, fundamentally different setup of sentience. Any self-conscious creature is self-conscious, can only be self-conscious in the same essential way, ultimately, and any non-self-conscious creature is an object in the experience of a self-conscious creature. And concerning those objects, there's innumerable such amounts, all of the millions of species, right, that know not of themselves. Right? The tree probably isn't thinking, oh, look at me, I'm a tree. The mosquito or fly probably isn't thinking, oh, look at me, how nice I fly. Right? We're thinking that. So that is something that reasoning does suggest. Right? That something such as we call the human being, when that dynamic between our initial base individuality and further prospects of development, that is a hard existential reality, and things must be that way. That is the sole conceivable way that these things can be. Again, the argument would go. As for the bodies in connection with which those human, what we would call then developmental processes can occur, again, we can't logically rule out that there's a diversity of such bodies. We've seen in our empirical investigations that on Earth, the only bodies, the correct inference in connection with which is that of human potentialities are Homo sapien bodies. We can't logically rule out that we would be proven wrong, right, and that we can find some species and it will communicate to us, that it can also be self-conscious. But that's just fantasy. To be perfectly frank, so now, at the present stage of argument, we cannot rule out, again, that there are bodies, animal bodies, in locales, places, such that are other than what would be considered to be Earth. Somewhere out there, right? Some of those dots in the sky, somewhere there. We can't rule that out at the present stage of argument. However, a further suggestion could be made, which would be that if we take that a priori view of things and we're thinking critically about the nature of reality, we may have little grounds to suppose that the rise of the human situation is something arbitrary, is something that is a chance happening, and therefore something that would be replicated innumerable amounts of instances. Obviously, if we take the naive, naturalistic view, that would be the conclusion that follows. But if we take a critical philosophical view, perhaps we would think otherwise. And if we grant the logically necessary character of the human situation and its supremacy in the scheme of things, then to suppose that there is, broadly speaking, a single such stage or arena for such development does not sound nearly as preposterous as it does under the thoughtless kind of worldviews. Right? There's just a bunch of stuff and the this and the that. So, for example, if we go visit the palace of some huge king back in the day, right? And we don't know any better, and we tour these giant grounds with thousands of rooms and hundreds, perhaps, of acres, we could be forgiven for feeling certain that there must be many, many kings and queens, monarchs that lived in this palace, right? How can it not be? Look at these thousands of rooms. What do we need all these thousands of rooms for? And yet we see that, generally speaking, if not always speaking, there's just one king, one queen, right? And the whole palace is centered around them. And that's the case when somebody is important. It makes sense that there's going to be a lot of land and there's going to be a lot of rooms for the servants and for the other people there and the court and all of this. It's not so insane, right? So just so here, if we adequately appreciate just how necessary and eternally necessary it seems that the human situation in its essentiality is, then it may feel at least far from silly to suggest that having an endless, perhaps, or at least a very vast arena for such an occasion is not superfluous, is not a waste of space, but would be something like the huge palace which houses one monarch. Right? And here, obviously, that would be an analogy for one huge universe that houses one such pinnacle of what is possible, existentially speaking. Whether or not that is factually so, here, certain observations can be useful, but that it is reasonable, right? When we really think things through, that does seem so. So, those are some things to think about in these connections. Thank you for listening.